Welcome to The Last Supper, your weekly podcast about art in Asia. I'm your host, Oscar Venhuis. Every weekend, I sit down and release an episode bringing new perspectives and engaging dialogues with emerging and established artists, galleries, curators, and collectors in Asia. Learn more about art in Asia with Christie's Education in-person and virtual art courses, gallery visits, and webinars. Visit Christie's Education website and enter all in capital letters LASTSUPPER15 to enjoy a 15% discount. The website link and discount code for Christie's Education can also be found in the description of this podcast. In today's episode, I sat down with Jolene Mock, an experimental artist. We talked about the range of subjects, but started with her experience of not being able to see anything, the mundane or the exciting part of boredom, heuristics, deep ocean exploration in Barbados, and the red forest of life is elsewhere. Welcome, Jolene. It's a real pleasure to finally catch up with you. How are you today?
I'm good. Well, this morning, I actually woke up exhausted from spending the whole week in the dark room, which I love, but at the same time I'm just exhausted, and it's kind of like a delayed exhaustion. Yeah, so now sitting here, all good, but yeah, like it's been a long yet productive and meaningful week. And the thing is, like, originally I was telling you that maybe we do it next week, but then because I was thinking if I couldn't finish all the developing during the weekdays, maybe I will like do it also today, but luckily I'm done with the, so I was like, yeah, if it's easier, let's do it today, like now. So yeah, that's good.
What makes working in a dark room so exhausting?
Okay, just this morning, I was explaining to my grandmother, she's in her late 80s, and because I'm staying with her this time in Eastern Hong Kong Island, and I was like, let me tell you what I've done this week. And then so I showed her all the film. Actually, I brought one of them to show you as well. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to bring my computer, but maybe I could bring something analog, you know? Like, I have got a stack of 10 of them, like 16 millimeter. And then I was just showing them to her. I'm so exhausted, like, this week. This is what I've done. And not the shooting part, because I've done the shooting part, of course, before the hand processing. And the thing is, I was telling her, like, you just asked me why I was so tired. She was thinking, maybe I was out and about running around town. I was like, no, the exact opposite. I was the whole time inside a dark room, windowless, sitting down. I mean, I stand a lot during the processing as well, but for most of the time when it's complete darkness, I just sit down, have my hand on the table, touching, feeling, sensing things, film and the spool, and then it's just so intense. And you know, the thing is, I'm a visual artist. I identify myself as one, a filmmaker, a video artist. But then the thing is, when you're in total darkness, you see nothing. And then you can only rely on your senses and hearing, because it's really complete darkness. And then so it's just like, you can only trust yourself in that sense without seeing anything. Maybe that's why it's so exhausting. It's just like, I use different senses, and I'm just sitting down indoor, peaceful, quiet, calm, because I have to. Otherwise, if I panic, film just get wrong easier even. And then so it's just like, yeah, the whole time, every day, from Monday till Friday, I was basically having the same routine. Just like I execute the same thing every day. And I didn't feel I was that tired during the week. But just this morning, waking up, like, almost as if I have a hangover. And I haven't been drinking for over a year. Like, and it's just like, I was like, whoa, this is how tired I got. And, oh my God, yeah.
I can imagine how exhausting that can be, because my dad is a retired photographer and we used to have a dark room at home as well. And I remember that the dark room is really, really dark, right? That's also why it's called a dark room. You really can't see your hands in front of your eyes, or whether you open or close your eyes is exactly the same. So you have to really rely on other senses.
Real dark room is just that it's no difference for you to open your eyes or close them. But I tend to close my eyes because it just helped myself to stay relaxed a bit, because I don't see anything anyway. So I was just like, yeah, it really doesn't matter if I close my eye or open my eyes. But I think have my eyes open even in complete darkness, it helps me a bit focus better in that sense. So I don't know, it's just kind of weird. But yeah, anyway, I learned a lot this week about like I don't know, it's not just about learning, it's also about experiencing. And the reason why I choose to do developing, like hand processing myself, is just I really loved it. And then the whole thing is because I would also identify myself as a Taipei media artist. I think in that sense, to be in the dark room hand processing the film is really the time I could experience time in synchronicity, like time-based media artist. And this is basically the only time in the dark room that I could really feel time. Maybe that's the attraction for me.
You mentioned that you're a time-based media artist. Explain to me what this means to you.
So basically, I think for art, it takes time to make. So it's a bit like weird to emphasize that. But for me, it's because I usually work with moving images. Even if I make photography, like still photography, my mind, my brain is still thinking in terms of the flowing of moments. It's time, like the flow of time. And then even if, like what I said, if I make still photography or sketches or drawings, it still comes to me that it's in a form of continuity in that sense, sequential. And then so for me, that's always the things that make me hook to the idea, concept, or where I started to think about the project or any ideas. And so I think time is that very essential feelings, sensation, or definition in the terms of how I conceive or create my work. And then so I think whether it's video, it's drawings, it's photography, or even if it's writing, then it's always time related and then or originated, and I cannot escape from it, I suppose. And then so that's what I think, that if I put it that way, I could communicate in a more specific terms with people, because usually they would ask, what do you mean by that? Like, because if you tell them you do video or you do film, people tend to already have that setup of a mindset of, oh yeah, okay, then I get it, what you are doing. But then if you are throwing out something that is more specific or a bit alienated from what they usually hear, then it's kind of help activate people to think a bit more, maybe. I don't know. For me, it's like that.
So you don't think it's simpler to say you are an artist without specifying or going into the details of your medium?
I like to be more specific, I guess, because if I'm just telling people that I'm an artist, it's almost as if I'm just categorizing myself as like an occupation. And for example, if you're an artist or scientist or like you're a musician, kind of like different categorization. But I think for me, there are so many different forms of art. Of course, it's also about like a living style. But then I think I want to enter into a conversation with people in a more like narrower direction, because it could be so wide all the time. And then so maybe that's why I put a label, and it's fluid. I could change it anytime I feel like, or I want, or if the fact that I don't see myself as an artist like that anymore. But I think at this certain point, or until now, I will still prefer to put it like that. And yeah.
You have worked at many places around the world, and it seems you have this kind of innate drive to explore other settings. What can you say about your motivation to go to very different environments? It almost feels like there's this competitive element in this. Why is that?
I think it's now a trend, no? I mean, even for you, you have been growing up in different countries, places. Because I like the way that you ask about me working or doing residency in different places. Because usually I don't see myself going to like tell people or to go to a country. Because I mean, country is very big. Where of the country you go, and even if you tell me the city, you never really explore the entire city. So like place is a good term in that sense, like time and place. And then referring back to your question about competition, no, not at all. Like I think the reason why I chose on this path is I want to be away from competition. Because it's as if I, not as if, but if I stayed in the same place, then you are kind of naturally entering this competition with your peers in that sense. It's like an arena that you just cannot avoid, that you are automatically, if you are in that circle, in that network, then you are being thrown to the like the range, and then you just have to start fighting in that sense, like to compete for something, to compete to a position or somewhere that you want yourself to achieve. and or you see other people achieving. And then so I think it's quite the exact opposite. And the reason why I love being in different places, particularly relatively remote or unknown, unfamiliar places, is because I could really meet the real people who live a life there. And it's just a place that not even tourists would be interested to go. And you brought up the word mundane just briefly when we were talking before the recording. It's just like, that's the whole point of what I'm interested in. And I don't know if it's even a trend or anything, but it's almost as if there are so much layers, volume, capacity in the mundane that people actually don't look at, but all things happen there. All the dramas actually unfold there. And then so it's just like, there's so much. And it's so mundane that it's never mundane. It's like that meta, I don't know, but it's just like the meta layering of stuff. And yeah, so it's just, and the your definition of mundane could be different from mine. And then it's just very interesting to be in a different place that I don't know about, that is actually a very native place for the people I met there. From this interaction or connection, then I learn something new every time. And I think learning something new is very important for me. Not that because I'm afraid of boredom. Actually, in my work, it deals with a lot of boredom. And usually I would ask the audience, isn't it boring for you to watch? Whether their answer is, but then it's somehow, I think, for me, it's just like, there is this intensity, maybe, between mundane boredom and excitement. And it's through wandering around these realms, then there's new things happening, or new things that I didn't see before. And then that's what drives me to keep making art in that sense.
I often wonder if the current interest in the mundane among artists is a response to the fast-paced development of the world we live in, by kind of deliberately slowing down or focusing and looking for boring moments that connect us with the present and nowness. Obviously, what is mundane is very subjective. Like, for some people, they find soccer or football super exciting, whereas other people find this extremely boring and mundane. So the mundane or the boring can be super exciting and at the same time super boring.
I think it's like, you remind me of like when you bring up the word focus. I think when it comes to making video, film or photography, there is so much about like tuning the focus and the shift of focus. So what you just described is like, for example, like what you said, football or golf or Formula One. Like when you know nothing about them, it's just like boredom. Like you're just like, what are these people doing? They're just taking laps after laps. And then, but at the same time, it's just like, if you could shift the focus, if you just find that shift in yourself or from the outside world, then basically it's not boring to you anymore. So it's just like, and like, also what you brought up about, so what is boredom? Like, it's maybe now we tend to use the word a lot of, conditioned. Like, how are we being conditioned culturally to understanding of things, of life, of, yeah, things in general. But at the same time, I think is, how are we trying to define things or to learn to define things in our own terms? And whether or not we could do that in education, or if education is doing that, because you never know. Like, because I think one thing now I would bring up is to unlearn. I think that's really the most precious things I pick up when I was in my undergraduate studies in Hong Kong, long time ago, but in the City University, the School of Creative Media. And I think the most valuable things, like for life, for me to pick up there is to unlearn. And while in this world, it's so much about learning, but actually, what are you learning? Like, if you don't really pay attention or being conscious of what you are learning, you could easily be brainwashed in that sense. But then at the same time, for me, it's just like, what I pick up there is, in the first semester when I was still a freshman, in my freshman's year, it's just like, you have to unlearn. I was like, huh? what do you mean? I'm coming to university to learn. What is that like to unlearn? I was just, yeah, that stays with me for life, I'm sure. And so it's just like, and going back to do, to undertaking artist residency in different places, every time is an unlearning process so I could learn more. And yeah, that's just, it's, I don't really try to define or explain it. It's just really the whole journey, the process of how I refresh or activate my brain from time to time so I could keep making works that even somehow fascinate myself, or to get to see the essence of the things that I'm attracted or interested in. So yeah, that's...
How do you unlearn, or what is your approach to unlearning?
Okay, from what I remember in my freshman year, because now it's just becoming a feeling, it's very, I internalize it, so if I have to put that in words, that's not an easy question. So basically, I think it's so much about not grabbing on to something that you already believed. You just have to allow yourself to question something that you thought is 100% correct. For example, I mean, if we just put it into a very personal level, for example, I'm born as a woman by gender, but am I? Like, for example, just for example, I could be, if I want myself to be another gender, I mean, in contemporary world. But then let's not put gender in that sense. Just for example, if I learn about languages in Hong Kong, like, I mean, because like I was born in the colonial times, and then so we pick up English and Cantonese and Chinese at the same time. And it's just like when it's coming to the learning of languages, we were so focused on you have to use it in a, with right grammar. And then you have to also express yourself clearly. But at the same time, we never really think about the potential or alternative use of languages, because we were just using it for communication, direct, clear communication. But actually, when there are times that there are expressions, emotions that cannot be communicated with words or languages, then how are you going to use languages in that sense? Or how could you not use it to be able to communicate some uncommunicable thoughts or feelings? And so I think in that sense, it's just, I would just have to always remember there's not just one way or one way to understand a particular thing in that sense.
Is it fair to say that thinking critically about something is part of unlearning?
Yes. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's the word. Yeah. Yeah, that's good one. Yeah.
I found unlearning a really fascinating subject, and how this relates to memory and behavior, and especially the mechanism of unlearning. How we make sense of the world around us is by making mental shortcuts or heuristics. If we would not have these shortcuts and make these mental assumptions, it would be really difficult to function. So is unlearning a matter of suppressing what we know, or can we literally forget things when you unlearn? So what I mean by that is that we completely forget something, so it is not in our memory anymore.
I think it has to do, what you just mentioned, has to do with like to give up on some very fixated things and to surrender. Like that would be the terms. And then you were bringing up a very interesting term, mental design. Oh no, mental shortcut. That's like, can you elaborate on that? Like, now is my turn to interview you, please. Like, mental shortcut.
Okay, I'll try to explain. I'm not sure if I'm the best person to explain what a mental shortcut is, but I'll try to explain it in my own words. So forgive me if it gets a little bit messy the way I explain it. A heuristic is basically a mental shortcut or a rule of thumb that reduces our cognitive load. For example, and I have to think of an example, let's say it rains outside, that when it rains outside, we need to take an umbrella. So this is a mental shortcut that helps us to save mental energy, because if we had to really think about why do we need to take an umbrella when it rains, what rain is, how do we actually open the umbrella, and why does it actually stop me from getting wet or you getting wet. So all those things, if we had to think about all those details, it would take a lot of mental energy. So we actually basically develop those mental shortcuts. Another example may be of a heuristic is when you get a cup of water. If you really think about all the steps of getting a cup, how to open the water tap, the placement of the cup under the water or exactly under the water tap, and when to switch it off so that it doesn't overflow. So these are all kind of steps that we don't think too much about it. So there are many heuristics in a single day, and to think about all these very deeply and deliberately would require a lot of mental energy, and you wouldn't be able to function to think about everything you do, from how you open a door to putting on your clothes. So it is important to have these mental shortcuts, while at the same time it is also good to have some kind of friction and mental dissonance. A lot of tools, for example, we develop from appointment booking systems to software to correct our grammar to, let's say, ChatGPT, is to reduce our mental load. So heuristics aren't inherently good or bad, but there are pros and cons to using them to make decisions. While they can help us figuring out a solution to a problem faster, they can also lead to inaccurate judgments about other people or situations. So I hope that explains a little bit about what a mental shortcut or heuristic is. But let's move on and talk about Barbados instead. Tell me the story, how you ended up in Barbados.
Well, I was actually only in Barbados like for a few days because I was there to depart for an scientific expedition, like a real one, like with marine biologists, or to be precise, it's deep sea marine biologists. And so it was the mooring point, so we have to get on the scientific vessel in Barbados. And then because the site that they were going to was in between the Caribbean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean. And then it's really the seeps, the border of these two oceans. And then because, as I said, they were deep sea marine biologists, so they don't want to get any close to any land. I mean, they want to get closest to the seafloor of that particular site. And then so Barbados was where we took off. And so I was in Barbados just for 2 days before the expedition, and maybe another 2 or 3 days after the expedition. And Barbados is not a very big island. I didn't make it to the whole island, but then I was there, chilling with other like marine biologist. Rum punch was the thing I drank there back then, and I remember it's pretty not even subtropical, maybe tropical in that sense. And then so it's just like, yeah, it's nice and breezy. And it was actually in August, maybe in June, I don't remember, but summer months. And so it was basically like nice, like sunny for most of the time, and that was Barbados that I remember. Have you been to Barbados?
No, I've never been to Barbados before. I think the closest place to Barbados that I've been to is Cuba. But how did you get involved in this project?
The thing is, I was actually just finishing up with the first year of my MFA studies in the North Carolina at Duke University. That was really like end of May was the end of the semester of the year, the first year, because it was a 2-year program. And all of a sudden, because I was in actually the inaugural class of the MFA program at Duke, and it was MFA in experimental and documentary arts. And then out of the blue, one day after the semester finished, the whole program, 15 of us, because we were in the inaugural class, it was only 15 of us in the first year, we received a mass email like to the 15 of us from the marine biology lab director at Duke. I mean, Duke is a very good university. And then so they have all these science, like all these kind of good department. And then they were just saying, oh, so we are actually going on a scientific expedition. And I'm very interested in, I have always been interested in working with artists or seeing how artists react to the environment, just like in general sense. And then so she was asking if any one of us, the 15 of us, would like to join them for the scientific expedition. And when I received that email, I was like, of course. Like, and then I replied right away. And so happened, I was the first one to reply. And because I'm always on my computer. And then for doing video editing and stuff. So she just have a quick chat with me face to face, like maybe a few days later. And then I got myself to join them for the trip. And ended up they have two spots on the cruise for the 15 of us. And then so me and another classmate joined them, but we were in different lakes. So I didn't go with her the same time. So basically when I joined the expedition with these like hardcore marine biology scientists, marine biologists, then I knew nobody on board. And they had come from completely different discipline, like science and art. And then, but the director of the lab was actually talking about, she want to put together or to see the intersection of art and science in a very broad terms. Like it's just like a way that should put two things together. And so it's very nice. It's very free in that sense. It's very experimental. That's the thing I love about. And then so it was because I was fast enough to reply the email. So I got myself this opportunity. I always described it as like a gift dropped from the sky. And then I just collected it, like, you know, in the right time and right space. And yeah, just like that.
And what else can you say about the purpose of this scientific journey and your own experience of this trip?
So I arrived in Barbados and on land for 2 days, a bit more, 2 or 3 days before the departure. And then I was actually on the cruise, they call it like a scientific vessel, for 11 days straight. And during that time, we were not doing any landings because, as I said, they are deep sea marine biologists. They want to be away from shore, land, and then to get to the ocean and to get to the deepest part of that area, which was actually 5,000 meters down in the seafloor. And the thing is, for the expedition I joined, there was a submersible vehicle. They call it ROV, remotely, it's ROV, I have to check it back up, I forgot, like, remote operating vehicle, yeah, something like that, ROV Jason. And then it's not a vehicle that you could actually put people inside, but it's remotely controlled by the technician, the pilot on board the scientific vessel. And then so the whole mission of that scientific journey was actually to get samples of the, in terms of geology and in terms of living organism and in terms of animals, not really animals, but yeah, living things, samples, and then to get the samples and water sample as well from the seafloor. And so basically the whole time during our exhibition, my lake was 11 days, and then I was just witnessing the scientists to do the scientific like exploration aboard the scientific vessels. So basically I also joined them to see in the pilot room how they actually put the vehicles down, submerge the vehicle down to the seafloor in 5,000 meters deep, because just from surface to put the things down to the seafloor 5,000 meters down there, it takes 2 hours for it to just go down. And it has to be a rather like calm day, because if it's stormy or if it's too wobbly, they cannot do that. And luckily we got days during that 11 days that they could do that. The return trip of the submersible is already like took like 4 hours for it to go down and come back up. And so it was just like seeing them playing video games in that sense, because they have so many monitors like installed in the vehicles. And then they have all these monitors and the cameras in the vehicles. And then with the lights, because down in the deep sea floor, there's no light, almost like a dark room, you know. And then so basically it's just like you can see the things that you have never seen before, like all those alien looking like jellyfish, or I don't even know if they're jellyfish, but then so it's just like quite fascinating. And then to see how they actually take the samples with these vehicles, machines, hands and stuff, clamps, and then yeah, so it was like that.
Once you finished this exploration in Barbados, what was the work or project that you developed for them?
It was a residency in that sense. as how we described it. And I actually didn't get any restriction. Oh, no, I did get one restriction. The scientist told me, the director told me, okay, because the whole point of us inviting artists aboard is not to scare people more about like all these scientific expedition or experiment. We don't want you to show or document anything that is bloody. But actually, there was not much blood. But that's what the one thing that they told me in the first place. I was like, okay, no problem. I'm also not into that. And then so that was really the only restriction, I would say. And for the rest, they just let me do whatever or not do whatever. Or just to experience it, see it, document it. But of course, I have the urge to create something out of it. So I was having my video tripod and then my digital camera with me at that time. And then so I was really just doing a lot of video shooting. And then I got an ocean of footage after I finished the expedition. Really, because I was in such an alienated environment, like aboard a scientific vessel that I didn't even know that things like that exist in the world in the first place. And now I'm entering into a new world, sort of, in that sense. So I was just hoping to document, to make records of the experience and the feelings of being with a group of people that is completely different from me. So I was actually, for most of the time, documenting the motion at sea that time, because I was shooting for most of the time, I mean, on land. And the style I shoot, pretty mundane, boring, is to really try to set the camera on a tripod and shoot things fair and square, just not to distract people from looking at it. Although it's moving images, but I mean everything moves. It's like I don't necessarily need to move my camera to capture movement or motion. And then I do move my camera, but it really highly depends on what I'm shooting. But then when I was at sea, like when you are trying to balance or set the horizon of the frame, there's not even one single second that you could do that because the whole thing is moving, like wobbly. Like what is the horizon? Like it's just like, woo, woo, like moving around. And then so for me, that was just mind blowing. It just turned my world upside down, you know, inside out, whatever. And then so I was just capturing that a lot because it's and also I have seasickness in the first day. And luckily I overcome it because I was not even drinking water in the first day because it's just impossible. Like even not drinking water, there is still something coming out like from your mouth. And then so it's just like, oh, but after the first day, I just realized that I just have to surrender to it. And the fear is in function. Then I would not be able to survive or enjoy the expedition. And it was quite an experience. And I just want myself to remember that. And then the documentation, the video documentation helps me with that. So ended up, I make a video installation of the motion, simply the motion of the expedition. And then, of course, I show them to the crew members on board and then the director. But I didn't like finish the work when I was at the ship. It's too short, 11 days. But then afterwards, then I was showing them like if they could come to the exhibition to see it. And also if they not, then I can send them the video documentation of the video installation. And then so for them, it's just to them, the wobbly world in the ship, they are just so used to it. Because I mean, almost like a mental shortcut. If you think about it, you do nothing about your scientific things, you know, so you just have to get used to it and then move on and then to focus on the things that you're supposed to focus, science, experimentation. But for me, because I have nothing to do with science, and then it's just like, this is what like really rocked my world. And then so when I show it to them, they also told me, like, it's very nice that they said, like, something that they didn't really see but were in it, then they really see it or feel it differently. And I think that's the whole point of the exhibition in that sense. And because I also did shoot some footage of scientists really making things with their microscope, like observing things and doing stuff. But I ended up didn't get to make a work out of it. I just have the raw footage with me. Maybe later on in my life, I would make use of them. But then with that expedition, then I make a work out of that. Like the motion, just the motion of movement.
I have a small favor to ask that will make a big impact. The Last Supper is offered to you at zero cost. And if you like this show about art in Asia, give this podcast a star rating or subscribe to this podcast channel. Many thanks and let's continue. Another project I would like to talk about is your book with the title Life is Elsewhere, Postcards from the Distant Land.
A book. I have one copy here. Not that I can show the listener, but then at least I could show it to you, Oscar. But yeah.
Okay. Describe to me what you are showing to me.
So this is my first book and possibly the only book in my life I make. Maybe, I don't know, maybe not. And then the thing is, I make this book earlier this year because of my first ever solo exhibition I did in my life. And it was in Hong Kong. And because it's through an open call, and I was doing it with 1A Space in Kettle Depot in Hong Kong, in Tok Kwa Wan, and they actually were asking for application about a Hong Kong artist, whether or not you are born in Hong Kong or you work in Hong Kong, and they have like holding or making this like solo, like mid-career retrospective. I was like, huh? But anyway, I applied. And then it's come to a publication altogether with the exhibition. And then so it was the first time that I get to really try to explain, maybe, my art practice to an audience in that sense. And so it comes with the book that is about my past 12 years of living or of the way I make work altogether in this book that now you are holding in your hands.
The way I would describe the book is that it is slightly smaller than an A4, so between an A4 and an A5. But the one feature that stands out for me is the green cover. Why did you choose this specific green color?
Very good question. Actually, there were two colors of the book. One is this not particularly green-green. The other one is not particularly pink-pink. So the story behind it, I'm really glad that you ask. So the book comes in two different covers, just colors, different colors, and the content are completely the same. The thing is, when I was deciding which color to use for the cover page, I was at the publishing house, and then I really couldn't decide. And then the publisher, the boss of the publishing company, just said, "You can use both." I was like, "Really? It's just the same price?" I was like, "Yeah, then let's do it." Because I can't decide. And the reason why I choose this not particularly green-green and the not particularly pink-pink is because of the cover image of this book. And this image on the cover of the book is actually a film copy of a 120 format still photography. And people would think it's heavily photoshopped because what you can see in the picture I try to describe is a forest and with a lot of reddish tree, which doesn't look normal in that sense. But I would have to say the story behind it is the negatives, the film negatives, is exactly like this. So how did it happen? People thought that it's like heavily photoshopped. No, not even one single bit of Photoshop involved in these photographs. It's because I came across this film, the infrared film, chrome. So it's a photo, like it's a chrome, so it's not it's a color reversal film. And it stopped. The production of this particular film stopped in 1997 because there is expiration date of film because of the chemicals. Then the last batch of this film produced in 1997 all expired in 2011. But with film, chemicals, there's one interesting thing that it could last longer than the expiration date is if you freeze them in the freezer. Then they're in kind of in hibernation. So then they could actually preserve forever in that sense. So the thing is, I was in this residency. The image is actually a forest in Aomori in Japan. And I was there during autumn in 2018, and it's a 3-month residency. So for a Hong Kong girl, a Gonglu in general speaking, when it comes to Japan, autumn Then the third thing, the third key words would be red leaves. And I'm not so much of a gong, but I'm just trying to make the story sound a bit funnier. And then the thing is, when I was at the residency, I was so excited that I would see a red forest in front of me. Because in Hong Kong, you know, we are forever green city. It's so green. And then the thing is, but when I was, because I started that autumn residency in September, early September, and then the residency ends in early December. So it's a good time that I could really witness what I wanted to witness. But then it's just a misconception or my undereducated, you know, knowledge to nature. Not all the trees turn red, come on. Like just certain trees, like maple trees or like other trees would turn red. And so the whole time I was waiting for the foliage to happen. And then the forest, they change into different colors, brownish, orange, like this forest in front of me. Just a very small bit of it turned red. But I was like, huh? But I really already in my mind, like I already have that image of the whole forest turning red, you know, like the photos we saw on Google when you look for red leaves Korea, red leaves Japan. I was like, no, I was just like obsessed with such image. And then so I just went Googling online to find how can I turn the forest red without Photoshop, like sound like crazy. But then because of that, I came across this film, the infrared color infrared film at Aerochrome. And the story of this film is super interesting because made by Kodak, the film company. And then actually it was made for a military purpose because like they use this film, the name of the film is Aerochrome, which basically they do aerial photography shooting with this film for surveying the forest to see if, like for military purpose, is to see if in the forest there are like hidden structure that is not supposed to be there or like some suspicious people hiding, like, yeah, things like that. And so, but this film was actually totally becoming like obsolete because of digital technology. Like they could do it easily with digital. And then so they stopped producing the film. And then in a German guy who lives in the West Coast of America, I didn't know how, when, what reason that he possessed a large portion and of the last batch of this film. And then he has been working with this film, he's a photographer, for over 10 years already that time. And then he was also selling a bit of this film, which is very nice because sometimes people don't want to share good stuff, you know? So I was like, and then so when I was doing my own research and then I saw him still selling that film, I was like, okay, let me just order like three rolls because they are quite expensive for me. Like I usually work with digital for most of the time. And then so it's like, I remember that time, including the postage, is 30 euros per roll and it's 120 format. So with 30 euros, you only get 10 images. So they're very precious for me. And then it's a very technical film in that sense. So I really was afraid that I was screwed up, you know? And then so when I got the film, so I found this film and I really want to use it. I ordered three rolls from him. And then I was shooting it with a very good Mamiya camera, 120 medium format camera at the residency because they have that camera in one of the drawers that nobody have touched it for years. And I asked them, can I use it? And then the residency staff said, yeah, of course, if you know how to use it. And then the funny story is, that was the only medium format camera I've used in my life because I took a photography class in my university back in the days in Hong Kong in the School of Creative Media, studio photography. That was exactly the camera I was using that time. So I told them, I know how to use this camera. But I was also thinking, with YouTube these days, you can even learn swimming on YouTube. Of course, I could learn how to use the camera on YouTube anyway. And then so I was having this good film, this interesting film, and then the good camera with me. And then so I was, for the first roll, I was really trying out because I don't want to ruin the film. It's so precious and scarce already. And then so after I finished the first roll, shooting the forest, then I was calling all the film developing lab, all the film lab in Japan, from Hokkaido to Okinawa, let's put it that way. Not even one lab was willing to process the film for me. but they do have a legit reason, because they said, your film is so expired. If we process it for you, there is possibility that the film would ruin our chemicals. I was like, yeah, fair enough. And then so I was like shouting for help to the guy who sold me the film. He's a German, but he lives on the west coast of America. And then so he was saying that, just send this film to me. I will help you to send it to the lab in Europe that I always go to. And then he will just, yeah, help me out with that. I was like, okay, thank God. I met some like good people. And then so it was such like long like time for waiting to see the film, because I have got three of the roles, but I didn't use all of them because I didn't know if I could use them correctly. And then so I really was looking forward to see the first role, if I did it right or if I did anything wrong, so I could learn and adjust. And then so when the image came back, this is the image, the most successful image in the first role. So I didn't screw up. And then, but also during this time, because of such a long waiting period, okay, so I finished the role and then I have to send it to America, and then he has to help me to send it to Europe and then send it back to him, and then he sent me back the things. It's such a long waiting time. And in this particular residency, they have a dark room, in-house dark room that nobody uses. And then so I was like, yeah, maybe it's time for me to really learn how to process color reversal film myself. And because I could use the darkroom basically 24/7 every day. So I was like, yeah, let me do that. And so I learned it from YouTube. And then, fascinating. And then so after that, basically all the images, like I usually work with, if it's analog, I really love to develop them, hand process them myself. Because I'd already explained it earlier, the whole like condition in the darkroom, the mindset and the mental space that I could get there. But at the same time, it just like, I really, maybe it also has to do with going back to the terms that really speak to me, mental shortcut. That if I chose not to do the developing myself, I could easily send it to a lab that I don't need to think about ruining anything, or I just need to spend some time to wait for it and to be distracted by other things. But at the same time, for me, it's just like the image making process has so much to do with also seeing the moment that the image review. Actually, I don't see it because it has to happen in complete darkness. But then knowing that the magic is happening, it's like, you know, you are kind of, you don't witness it, but then it's there. And then you remember about the whole thing. And then to really go with the flow, to trust yourself, it's like priceless. It's so precious. And then so it was like, yeah, that's why, okay, I always just wander around when I talk. And then so coming back to the book cover, the reason why I choose the color of green and pink is because the other name of this film is actually called False Color Film. And true and false is very interesting concept in that sense. Because this is an infrared sensitive film, it's just that our eyes cannot see infrared. Doesn't mean that it's false. But in human terms, a very human-centered idea, that is false color film, because it's not the color we see. So I was like, okay. And so when it comes to the color, the cover of the book, then I was like, yeah, green and pink would be the go-to color, because the forest was originally green. But then in this photograph, the forest is red. So what is true and false? I don't know. I don't even know. But at the same time, that's why I choose the two different colors. But today I bring with me the green one. Yeah, the original green of the not so green of the forest, and then the other one is not so pink. That actually resonates a bit with the picture itself.
So your darkroom experience has come to an end with it's a project for the M Plus Museum here in Hong Kong. When you have the link, I'll post it in a description of this podcast. But what is next?
So the thing is, I just landed myself this commission in mid-June, the 2 days after I land back in Hong Kong, because the deadline of the application, of the by invitation call, was the day I left Oslo from a 2 month residency. So I submit my proposal, the application deck, to M+ just before I hop onto the plane to come back to Hong Kong after a 2 month residency in Norway. And so I was supposed to know about the result 2 days after my arrival. And then it took a bit longer, a weekend after that. So it's like 4 days. And then so I knew about the result on a Monday evening. So it was just 2 months ago. And then I was already telling them, like, I would only want to shoot with film. Would you support that? And luckily they did. They do. And then so even like with this, don't want to go over the budget because basically like it's a commission, but then I don't earn anything basically. But I don't, yeah, this doesn't need to go on there. But then the thing is, I was really thinking that if I shoot with digital, I wouldn't even shoot it. Like, because I need to make meaning for myself to be wanting all the experience that I really want to engage in. And then so, and actually I haven't been making work in Hong Kong for over a decade. Because every time when in between residency, when I come back to Hong Kong to see families and just be back home for a bit before I go again, it's never really the time for me to produce or to create. It's just to be home. And so I just really realized that this is like quite a time to just make things. And with the exhibition I put together earlier this year and the book, I was not really creating a new work, but to make a recollection of the work I already did in the past 12 years and into a form of book and an exhibition. And so this work that I'm now making, still in the middle of it, is really a work that well, I don't even know how to describe that. But then, so I was really hoping to shoot it in 16 and I insisted, and then I was allowed to do that. And I already also knew that I'm going to hand process it by myself because I don't get the occasion to shoot film much. And if this time I get the opportunity to do it, then it's also a very precious opportunity to hand process it by myself. But of course, it's such a high risk because shooting film is already very uncertain media in that sense, medium. And then my cameraman was just also saying that, are you sure you want to hand process it yourself? Because if you screwed up, then you got nothing. Oh, like, well, I would just take the risk. And then so it's very risky. And then actually it took me weeks to build up this mentality to really be able to trust myself that I can do it, even though I don't know if I could really do it. But then, I mean, I've hand processed film before, but not as intense. Like, I have got 10 rolls of 100 feet and it's a lot in that sense. And then so now in this particular point right now, I've done with the developing, the hand processing of the film and the shooting, of course. And then so the next things would be to scan the film in 4K quality. But I'm not going to do it myself. I have to send the film to a film lab to do it for me. And then I have to wait for them to do it and then return back to me the file. So at this very particular point, I still am not sure what I've shot, you know? I mean, of course, I saw the frames when I rolled the film, developed the film and stuff. But then seeing the film strips is very different from really seeing the footage, because it took away the time, the sense of time in the film, because it's just frames after frames after frames, and it like 100 feet of plastic strips just hold all these images. And then so I'm now still looking forward to get the scanned image and to see what exactly happened. And yeah, so this is, yeah.
Is it possible to scan this in Hong Kong, or where do you do this?
No, they don't do it in Hong Kong. I think what I heard is, like, what I knew is basically in Asia, they do it in Japan and also in Taiwan. But the friend who also, and my cameraman actually, have always been sending the film to a very reliable lab in America, in the States. And then so he was just recommending me to do that, and I would just take his recommendation. And because I've taken enough risk already, so I just better go with a safer bet now after all these weeks. I mean, I shouldn't make it even more risky. I mean, I already took the risky path, but then okay, now we're settled in the sense that we got images. And then so I really just want to see what I shot, actually. So, yeah, we'll see.
And when will this be shown?
So, because it's a short film commission, the final work will have to be in between 3 to 5 minutes. And, well, to give you a sense of what I have shot 10 rolls of 100 feet of 16 millimeters black and white film stock in double X. And then with each 100 feet of 16 millimeter film, it shot in between 2.5 to 3 minutes because it's really not quite the same in each roll, but it's always fall between 2.5 and 3 minutes of footage. So now I've got 10 of them. So I've got about less than 30 minutes of footage, and I will need to put together a 3 to 5 minutes film. And M+ is going to have a screening to hold a screening program in mid-November. Yeah, M+ is going to hold a screening and the premiere of the film in mid-November this year, 2023. And so I will have to finish the editing of the work by the end of September, like a month later. And then for the month of October, it will be for the film to go through censorship and stuff. And then, yeah, so the screening will take place in mid-November. And also, they will also show the work on the M+ facade and on the staircase in M+ Museum and stuff. And yeah, so it's really the first time I'm working on a commission, so I'm excited for it. But I mean, the commission itself is not that exciting. It's the whole process. I make it more exciting in that sense. I love to do things like that. Yeah.
You've done many residencies. Do you already know where your next destination will be?
That's a good question. Well, so the thing is, I have got a couple of residencies that I couldn't do during the pandemic because, you know, the whole world basically shut down. And then so I still am looking for the time and the slot that I could do the residency I was supposed to do back then and reschedule them in the coming months, years. And also I will apply for new residencies to because it's always like, I mean, I did told you about the residency I did with the scientists. It didn't always happen like that, it doesn't. It's just like, yeah, usually I need to apply to open calls. So my full-time job is actually to apply for open calls. And then for over a decade. And then already. And then so the thing is, I will still do that. And then to try to just keep going, like with making works in residencies. But I think at the same time, with this opportunity to work on a commission project in Hong Kong, which is like the first time in my life. And also, maybe that could also be a different possibility of making more work in Hong Kong. Who knows? I mean, I'm open to the idea, but at the same time, I also don't want myself to settle with the idea of doing that. So I think I would just keep going to look for residencies in or wherever, and at the same time be open to the possibility that I could get in Hong Kong to create works. And yeah, that's basically it.
I know you need to go soon, so I'm going to ask you the final question of this podcast. If you were to have your last supper, who would you invite beside your family members, of course, and what would you talk about during your last meal?
Well, I would invite John Cage, just because he's John Cage. I'm actually not very familiar with his work, but I read a lot about his views on life. And the other thing is because he's a mushroom forager. Seriously, that's like what I learned from a previous residency I did in Finland, just exactly a year ago during the mushroom season. And, you know, like in Hong Kong, when you tell people about foraging mushroom, they think that you are nutcase. Like, and in Hong Kong news, it's so much about when you see people foraging mushroom, the result is always they end up in the hospital having put food poisoning. There's no other alternative. People are like, they demonize foraging mushroom or foraging anything in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is just not a place for forager in that sense, but I still want to forage in Hong Kong. But then, so like, yeah, if just to begin with one, I would like to invite John Cage, not because of his astounding work in acoustic or like audio kind of room, but he really to untangle this beautiful mind over a dinner, you know, and to discuss, I don't know, like really about mushroom. There's so many things to learn about mycology, about foraging, about mushroom. Yeah, and also to ask him about his views on daily living, on the mundane, because I think he's a very good person to talk to about being sensitive to the mundane. And yeah, so yeah.
Many thanks, Jolene, and all the best with your upcoming shows.
Thanks, Oscar, for inviting me to talk.
Many thanks for listening to today's episode of The Last Supper with experimental artist Jolene Mock. If you like this show about art in Asia, you can support us by giving this episode a star rating and subscribing to this podcast. If you have any questions, suggestions, or wish to participate in this podcast, you can contact me on oscar@thelastsupper.asia. You can visit my website www.thelastsupper.asia as well, or contact me direct on Instagram @thelastsupper.asia.